Oh, looking back at the social history of the psychedelic movement and the LSD in particular, the name John Beresford does not loom large in popular culture. And yet, to those whose names do loom large, his name looms large. Dr. Beresford is somebody I'm going to be meeting along with you. He is, all I know, is he is the individual who introduced LSD to Timothy Leary, who was at the time making his psychedelic explorations with mushrooms. Welcome to the program, Dr. Beresford, your historical figure.
Well, thank you very much, Roy, for the opportunity to be on your program. What would you like to know?
Well, let me see. Where do you fit in this? We go from Dr. Albert Hoffman in Sandoz to Dr. Timothy Leary, and you're in between there. So where did you come from? Where is your interest in LSD and your explorations?
Well, that's rather a big question. I'm English, as you probably can tell.
I guess.
I came to the United States after studying medicine at London Hospital. I practiced in New York for a number of years until I was introduced to LSD through a friend, and became immediately aware of the importance of the introduction of this agent to Western culture and civilization. The little incident about my playing a part in Timothy Leary becoming acquainted with the effect of LSD is really quite trivial. It was simply that I, at one point, gave a certain amount of this material to a fellow called Michael Hollingshead, who in turn gave it to Tim. I didn't really play any more active a role than that. What I would like to talk about, however, is my present interest in the scandal that is presently afflicting the United States in the form of the drug war, the war on drugs. After I retired from the practice of psychiatry in Toronto, where I was living until last December, when I emigrated to Los Angeles.
You're a native here now.
Definitely. I'm a United States citizen, so...
American.
Yeah.
Okay. And, well, you'll have to learn to talk American then, you know.
Well, I sometimes do my best.
Okay.
Yeah, I was living in Canada. I emigrated from the U.S. to Canada, so that, in fact, I'm a Canadian citizen as well, and engaged in the practice of psychiatry for 15 years or so, retiring in about 1990 or 1991. And after that, I went to live in a monastery in the province of Ontario, and I would probably still be there to this day if I hadn't answered an ad in High Times magazine in, what was it, the end of 92, which had been put there by an individual, a young man, his name is Brian Adams, who told the readers of High Times that he was presently in prison for LSD for 10 years. He had just got out of high school. And if anyone was interested to know why the sentence was so extraordinarily long, they could correspond with him and he perhaps would be able to inform them. At any rate, I wrote to Brian. I told him I was interested, and I became aware of what at the time was called the carrier weight problem, meaning that if you are prosecuted for an offense involving LSD, it's not the LSD itself that will determine your sentence, but the weight of the LSD and the blotter paper or whatever other material the LSD happens to be sitting on. The weight of the combination is what determines the length of the time that you will serve in prison. And that is the so-called carrier weight problem. At any rate,
Does this mean if you put LSD on a helium balloon, then the arresting officer will have to serve time?
The arresting officer will have to serve time. I'd be very glad to see that happen. I don't know if it would be as simple a matter to contrive as that. But Certainly, if you drop LSD in orange juice, you are liable to be convicted on the weight of the orange juice, if you can believe that. However, this is just one aspect of the many instances of injustice that prevail in the U.S. drug war sentencing world. And Brian Adams was the first person I came in contact with in that connection. Through Brian, I met a whole network of other people serving time in state and federal prisons. I used to visit people in prison, communicate with them, correspond with them. I still, to this day, have my home telephone number connected with, or my home telephone number is on their telephone lists in a certain number of cases. And I, through this means, come to know pretty well the inside story of the war on drugs, and it's quite a dreadful story, I can tell you. By visiting prisoners, by coming to know prisoners extremely well, you do yourself a favor. You get to know the inside story of the drug war, and there's no other source of information, in my opinion, that anywhere near equals that. You certainly don't get it from the government propaganda, nor do you get it from the universities, nor do you get it from the media. Believe me, you get it from prisoners. They are the ones who know. In front of me right now, I have a photo album of these many, many prisoners that I've come to know. And right now the album is open at a page. It's got Amy Pofal on the left, and underneath her name I've written 24 years for MDMA or ecstasy. And opposite her is Tonya Drake, and underneath her name is written 10 years for cocaine. Now both these women obviously don't belong in prison. They are both very beautiful people. They both committed no crime in the sense that I would accept that word.
Well, MDMA was used as a drug in psychotherapeutic situations, and one of the groups that was most opposed to making it illegal were psychotherapists, I understand.
Yes, I don't know the full story of that incident. I never used psychedelic drugs myself in practice when I was in psychiatry. It was illegal to do so in Canada at the time, and I happen to be a person who never does anything illegal. Amy's story is a little more complicated than it may sound. She, in fact, was indicted and convicted on a charge of conspiracy to manufacture MDMA. The use of the word conspiracy is problematic, to say the least, in the war on drugs. Amy had separated from her husband the year before, had come to live in Los Angeles, was operating a small business of her own to support herself. And her husband, meanwhile, had traveled to Germany and was organizing the manufacture of MDMA in a German chemical plant called Imhausen in the small town of Lahr in central Germany. And a scandal developed around this company, in that it was found that Imhausen had been manufacturing poison gas for Colonel Gaddafi of ill fame in Libya at the time of the Libyan incident. Did you want to say something, Roy?
No, I just thought that the poison gas is okay, I'm sure, according to our laws. It just the MDMA would make people nervous in our legal system.
Perhaps. At any rate, in the course of the investigation, it was accidentally discovered that this MDMA manufacturing operation had been going on at a time when some people say it was still legal to do so in Germany. However, it was definitely not illegal in the United States, and the story is that some part of the manufacturer had found its way to the United States, which made Mr. Pofal, Amy's husband, an indictable defendant in the United States. Now, because he was a resident of Germany at the time, he was outside the reach of the Drug Enforcement Administration, and Amy herself then became the focus of their attention. I'm not going to go through the extraordinary abuse that Amy was subjected to over a period of 2 years in order to get her to what was called cooperate with the federal authorities in wearing a hidden microphone, perhaps, in giving information about anyone she might have come in contact with at any time in her life, perhaps. Who knows what cooperation would mean in her case? At any rate, she refused to do so and drew down the wrath of the federal government in the form of a 24-year sentence, having nothing whatever to do with the manufacture of this chemical. She, in fact, was a, you could say, a thought criminal. She was convicted of conspiracy to manufacture. She may or may not have known something about it. She claims that she didn't.
Of course, conspiracy in our legal system is a way that people can get convicted without the authorities having to come up with any proof.
Yes, I think it's possible to call it a conspiracy. It's a device which can entrap people. There does not need to be any exchange of drug substances, certainly no exchange of money, for you to be caught in the conspiracy net. Nicole Richardson, a young student, again just out of high school, was convicted for conspiracy because her voice was recorded on the telephone telling somebody where to find her boyfriend. Her boyfriend was distributing presumably a small amount of LSD among his friends at school, or I'm not quite sure what the circumstances were. But Nicole was sentenced for conspiracy and is now still serving time in a federal prison. I don't know, she must be in her early 20s or mid-20s by now, and that is the sum total of the offense that she committed. Her voice was recorded on the telephone. Another case in New Jersey. I'll call him Jack. His wife, Mary, they were married. Both liked smoking pot, but when she became pregnant, stopped smoking pot. 9 months later, their firstborn son came into the world, and they decided to celebrate, and what better way of doing so than by calling the dealer and seeing if he had any material that he could supply them with. The dealer had been himself arrested and had been brainwashed, had been prevailed upon to turn into an informant. And we have to remember that informants do not just inform, they have to find people to inform about. So when the phone call came through from Jack, the dealer replied saying, nothing in right now, but when something does, I'll let you know. And then a month later, when the dealer called Jack and told him that a supply of material had come in, it was a big deal, fabulous quality, good price, and so forth, but it needed a number of people to become involved in the what was going to be quite a big sale. So Jack and his wife drew some money out of the bank, and when the bust came that night, he was found with $3,000 in the bank with all this prior conversation recorded with the man who had once been his dealer. He went to court, was sentenced to 20 years in prison, lost, of course, his little business as a plumber, and he pleaded before sentencing with the judge and said, Your Honor, my little son has just come into the world. Please let me do some community service or something. Let me grow up with him. Let him grow up with me. And the judge silenced him and said, You should have thought of that before, and put him away for 20 years. 20 years, yeah. And so my photo album is full of people with stories like this. And so what I'm really trying to tell you, Roy, is that, or your listeners, is that the real way to understand the iniquity that is committed in the name of the war on drugs is to talk to and get to know and communicate with the prisoners who are the victims of this war on drugs. It's something that wrenches your heart when you come to know about it.
How many people is it estimated are being victimized by this war on drugs?
Well, there are probably 500,000 people in prison right now. It's said that 2/3 of federal prisoners are in prison for drug offenses alone, 2/3. And I'm not quite sure what the figure in the state prisons is. It could be 20-25%, but it adds up to a total of around about 500,000 people in prison. And that is to say nothing of those on parole and probation. The United States has, it's estimated, almost 3% of its adult population in prison right now, and a sizable chunk of that 3%. In the criminal justice system, that's prison, parole, and probation, 3% of the adult population, with a big chunk of that being made up of drug prisoners. That's how many.
So that's about over 500,000 people in prison for nonviolent offenses at $25,000 to $30,000 per year apiece, adds up to a sizable chunk of change. In the meantime, where we have the drug war, our drug population, our drug-using population is getting younger and younger and larger, and meanwhile, in more enlightened countries such as Amsterdam, cities, the drug-using population is getting older and older and smaller and smaller. Mm-hmm. So the money is being worse than wasted here.
Well, I know a lot of people will speak in economic terms and tell us about the waste of public funds and the taxpayers' money going straight down the drain. However, if we remember that we're talking about a war on drugs, it is a war. And if you're fighting a war, money doesn't really matter. You'll pay whatever it costs to win that war. So although it makes sense to the educated person to resent the $25,000, $30,000 a year that you speak of to maintain each individual person in prison for a year, even in that event, it is still possible to say that the moral question of removing the drug-using population from society is a sufficient cause to warrant fighting the war on drugs. The money doesn't really matter in the long run. Deep down, if you feel emotionally that taking drugs is wrong, you're going to justify any amount of cash that is put into the system, which is designed to solve the problem, to win the war. I've always felt that the important question is not the economic one, but the moral one, the question of justice and injustice, to my mind, overrides the amount of money that is spent on the war on drugs.
Well, maybe my position is a little cynical, but looking at the core of the impetus in this insane war on drugs, which is counterproductive, according to what's figures, government's own figures, it seems to me the impetus could not possibly be to end drug use, since it increases drug use, but the impetus where the war on drugs is being a success is in the fastest or second fastest growing business in the country, which is prisons, prison construction, and prison guards, and the tremendous amount of political power the prison guards now have. So the prison constructors and the prison guards, acting as a pressure group, would want to keep this good thing going, victimizing people in order to increase their business, which they're doing very well, when actually the drug use and the drug people and the drug populations is going the exact opposite of what the war on drugs would ostensibly be seeking. So that's why, from which my view, perhaps cynical, is that it is an economic war against the country, using the war on drugs as a rationale.
Yes, I know. I guess there are different ways of looking at it, of course. One can also think of it in religious terms. I sometimes think of the war on drugs as being a recrudescence of the old twisted Puritan spirit, where society has to be cleansed of the polluting agent which may damage souls and so forth. I think also very problematic when you consider the effects of the injustice that has become endemic and institutionalized in the prosecution of the drug war, because injustice in this one area flows over into many others, and the effects of the methods used to fight the drug war flow into the criminal justice system, into the courts, into the mandatory minimum sentencing provisions, into the use of informants. The country is infested with informants, paid sometimes and unpaid. The testimony given in courts is tainted frequently and has been admitted to be so by judges. Police brutality is justified if the cause of police intervention has to do with drugs. The Fourth Amendment has been granted what the Supreme Court has called the drug exception, so you no longer have to get a warrant to break into somebody's house if you're a police officer. You can do so on the strength of your own stated belief that there is a good cause for you to do so, openly flouting the provision made by the founding fathers for the protection of the citizen against police abuse, government abuse, the drug exception to the Fourth Amendment.
This is KPFK Los Angeles. We are on live as of April 2nd, 1996 with Dr. John Beresford, and we are talking on the drug war, and we'll be soon joined by Dennis Bernstein. And you are listening to Something's Happening on KPFK Los Angeles, featuring Dynamite Radio for Night People, Monday through Thursday, midnight to 6, and we are on live with Dr. John Beresford. We have a serious problem in this free country, Dr. Beresford, and I admire anybody who's putting their efforts in this very dangerous and ugly aspect of our society.
Did you want me to go on? So what would you like me to say next?
Well, is there... I always have people thinking, what can I do? What can we do?
What can we do?
What can be done? What can I do? What can we do? These people are in jail. The money's going into the arms of the people who are breaking our laws under the cover of laws. There's increasing hysteria. This drug war is unprofitable, unproductive, going against the ends, the ostensible ends of the drug warriors. Our people are being, our laws are being undermined. Our freedom is being undermined. Drug use is growing because of these laws and because of the drug war. And what can one do except be depressed? Well, there must be something that one can do.
Well, one can flee the country, that's one thing. I've just come back from Amsterdam, and I was told there that there are now 10,000 refugees from the drug war fleeing the United States, and the figure is thought to be going up to 25,000 in Amsterdam alone by the end of the century. So one can escape. That's one way out.
Well, one would say, drug warrior, well, these people, it's good for the country to get rid of these kind of people. So good riddance to them. We don't need them, and they're probably the worst people in our society.
Well, not necessarily. Here I've got a photograph of a young couple in Amsterdam. I became involved in this case. It's an extradition case. Les and Cheryl Mooring, you can see them here, Roy. They look like nice people, right?
Yeah.
The United States is seeking extradition of these two people from Holland, from the Netherlands, because they fled the jurisdiction of the federal government in Arkansas. He was growing some pot plants on the family farm. She doesn't smoke. He had a motorcycle accident and uses medical marijuana. And because of previous offenses, he stands to gain a 40-year prison sentence. And she, because she knew the growing operation was going on but didn't rat on her husband, is charged with conspiracy and is subject to a 20-year sentence. By a quirk of fate, Les and Cheryl were on bail when the negotiations around sentencing, or conviction, I should say, rather, were going on, and fled the jurisdiction of the court and sought refuge in Holland, knowing that their life together was probably going to be ended. And because the international law around extradition provides courts with one loophole, namely that if the country to which an individual is to be extradited imposes sentences that are, quotes, inhumane and degrading, that the court in the extraditing country can refuse extradition. And this, we all very much hope, is what's going to happen in the Moorings case. It's not very often that the federal government loses a case, loses a victim. It lost one in Canada fairly recently, where the Canadian Supreme Court refused to extradite a cocaine defendant to the United States because of the extraordinary disparity between Canadian sentencing and United States sentencing. So it's possible that a movement may be possible to generate whereby extradition of drug cases will be refused. You were asking me, what can we do? And you were speaking of Amsterdam. It reminded me of that story. What can we do? Well, I'm not really in a position to tell you, Roy, or anyone what you should do. I know what I do. I try to publicize the stories of prisoners. I give slide presentations I actually read messages from prisoners to audiences. I did one at the Drug Policy Foundation here in Santa Monica in October in 1995. And I made a similar presentation at the international conference we had on drug war prisoners in Heidelberg in February, and again did a presentation in London to the UK conference on drug war prisoners. And I believe that it's important to get the message of the prisoners out to the public, because if you know their stories, you too, I believe, will feel, as I do, that it's impossible to sit down and let this iniquity happen. You have to do something about it. So getting people to talk, getting words into the press, encouraging communication, encouraging a dialogue, as in contrast to the monologue that we hear from the drug authorities, principally the Drug Enforcement Administration, to get a dialogue going is, I think, the is an important activity that anyone can undertake. How you do it, I think, depends on your own predilections, your own gifts of communication, your own ambition. It's not very easy to get into prisons. It's not very easy to establish communication with drug prisoners or any prisoners for that matter, but it can be done. And I think it's important to do it also from a rather theoretical point of view, which is that, you see, the prison represents the internal boundary of the state, just as the external boundary is the border of that state geographically with another state. The prison is the internal boundary of the state, which the ruling authority is not too keen on having the citizen penetrate. So by crossing that boundary, by melting the wall, by establishing communication, by allowing prisoners to feel in contact with the outside world and vice versa, I think we're doing something tangible to weaken the grip that the drug war has on our mentality. So there's that, you might say, abstract way of putting it as well.
Well, one of the people who has put some of this information in print, about to be put in print, is Dennis Bernstein, one of our ongoing investigative reporters for Pacifica and others. Now, he's located at KPFA most of the time, although he comes down here every once in a while and we hear Dennis's programs. And he has an article in the April Z magazine on drug war POWs. We have Dennis on the telephone. We woke him up in Berkeley. Dennis?
I'm here. I could not hear what was being discussed.
Oh.
So,
we're talking
give me
about,
one line.
We're talking about drug war prisoners.
And
the possibility of what we can do to get some of these people from their unfortunate situation, getting through to them, allowing them to get through to us with their stories, their horrendous stories about the lawlessness committed by our lawgivers and our law enforcers, these horrendous sentences for victimless and other minuscule crimes,
right, where
the undermining of our laws.
Right, I got it. Well, I think one of the things that I probably could talk about that would sort of add something is based on
survival,
some research
control.
We did for an article that's in Z Magazine this month. And that's, you know, I've been really sort of taking a look at how outrageous sort of the empowerment of, through these various drug laws based on the 1986 congressional, national, whatever the hell it's called, drug law, that empowered all these local police departments to pump up their budgets with the seizures, and how that's empowered these sort of state and local police departments to have their own little thrones, and these people are going wild with this power. And so it's sort of like target practice when it comes to, particularly, you know, when the dead were playing and it was you know, just sort of like shooting fish in a bowl for the DEA to come in, arrest lots of people give them, thousands of years of time based on ridiculous carrier weight minimums, pump up their budgets that way, and fill the prisons with thousands of kids who are serving 10 and 20 years. I did some research about what was going on in Hazard, Kentucky, and I, for instance, tracked this cop, Mark Lopez, who is tracking anybody and everybody, following kids who are trying to straighten out from cocaine into drug rehabilitation programs, forcing them into becoming dealers, in this instance for this officer, extorting money from informants, using informants to deal materials that have been seized, both drugs and weapons. And this is happening all over the country. And kids using LSD have been one of the main easy targets of this kind of outrageous behavior based on draconian victimless crime drug laws.
Yes,
and that's what we write about. And this really has to be focused on. There has to be more reporting about this because it is out of hand. It is out of control.
Dr. Beresford?
Yes, I think you're very right, Dennis. There's a famous case right now in Atlanta prison, the federal prison in Atlanta. A young guy, Tim Tyler, you may know about him, for life, sentenced to life. He had two previous offenses, both trivial enough to be awarded probation, but with the three strikes and you are out provisions, bang. He is a Grateful Dead fan. His father also is a Grateful Dead fan, and the two of them were involved in some kind of deal selling LSD, and because it was Tim's third shot, he is now sitting in that prison for the rest of his natural life.
It is unbelievable. I think of Heather Silverstein.
Right.
Sitting in this jail. I don't know if you played the tape or...
Not yet. No, I have it, though.
But I just think about this young woman who escapes from a horrific family situation, is really troubled, goes on the road, gets involved in very heavy drugs, then comes upon the dead scene, meets some nice people, takes LSD, really slows down, drops all the other hard drugs, slows down on the LSD, gets her life together, gets a business started, and because they get busted and sort of caught in one of these LSD crossfires, you know, she and her husband are both serving, like, I don't know, 5 or 10 years, and...
Yeah, she's 8 and he's 10.
8 and 10 years. Mm-hmm. And these are soft, beautiful people who truly could be contributing to society, and we're paying, $30,000, $40,000 a year to keep these people in prison. Mm-hmm. If I could make one other point, I was thinking about one person who was imprisoned in Kentucky, and this is the person I was referred to. They tracked into a Narcotics Anonymous program. Mm-hmm. He was going back to school. He had a 4.0 average. He was the editor of the literary magazine. Mm-hmm. I kept saying to myself, why are they going after him? Why do they want this guy in prison? Then I realized why.
Why?
Because actually, he makes the perfect prisoner for the prison industry. He's now sort of like a department manager for complaints of some major prison industry. Mm-hmm. And he's cheap labor.
But,
so
it doesn't really matter. The person's qualifications don't matter all that much because it's bodies that can't. I'm told that it's not uncommon in prisons to see old people, old men, old women, people paralyzed in wheelchairs, paraplegics even. They don't care who they get as long as they get you.
Oh, well, and that's also because people are now serving longer sentences. We're seeing sort of generations in prison, and, the system is expanding.
Yeah, there are some cases where two entire generations of one family are in prison, the parents and their parents and uncles and aunts and cousins, entire two generations of a single family.
It is really hard to conceive of the situation. I know in one case, through these drug conspiracy laws, the situation goes like this. A woman just happens to answer the telephone when somebody is calling for her husband, a small-time drug dealer.
Mm-hmm.
The woman tells the person calling for the small-time drug dealer, who's an informant, where to call her husband. For that assistance,
mm-hmm.
she ends up getting 10 years in jail, being involved in a felony conspiracy
mm-hmm.
to distribute LSD.
Mm-hmm.
So while she's in jail, somebody breaks into her house where she lived with her mother and rapes her mother.
Mm-hmm.
The rapist gets 3 to 5.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is really, really out of control. The DEA hasn't had a major drug bust since 1981, and their budget keeps going up.
What do you think about the fate of the children, Dennis? The children left behind where their parents are arrested and taken away.
Well, that's, you know, one of the horrific things of the LSD laws is that it really went after sort of these young people with kids, because they would get them to sort of become the snitches, threatening to separate them, to break up
mm-hmm.
the family.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of the tapes you made, you have the one with Nancy.
Yes, we do.
She has 2 or 3 children. Nancy never had a parking violation. She
mm-hmm.
worked as a trainer, you know, training high school dropouts to get trades and use computers. She was like a Berkeley special,
mm-hmm.
Counterculture. And she has children. She's going to serve 10 years in jail.
No, more than that. 23.
Is it more? I don't even know. I mean, it's just out of hand. Is it
mm-hmm.
10? Is it 15? They're fighting to have 10 years.
And
the amazing thing is that in the courts, the judges in this most recent sort of battle about mandatory minimums and carry weight and stuff, the Supreme Court says, yeah, it's ridiculous, it's bizarre, it's totally unacceptable, but it's not a judicial situation, it has to go back to Congress. Congress is running for re-election. They're going to make the drug laws more draconian. They're going to, expand it in any way, shape, or form. So Congress, and it's the Democrats, by the way, let's be really clear, I don't care if the Republicans are in charge. It has always been the Democrats that have opened this vista. And in this latest round, it was the Democrats fighting for the anti-crime and the right-wing Republicans, ironically, opposing it.
Mm-hmm.
You catch that?
Drug war always gets worse, because wars always do until they end.
Well, now we have a real general.
Mm. But we also have the death penalty.
Right.
It was introduced in the 1994 crime bill. The provision was made for the death penalty be applied for by prosecutors in the case of importation of X amount of drugs. It's quite clear to me that the next step has to be that the same quantity of drug material will be eligible for the death penalty when manufactured or grown within the country. There always is an escalation. It's one step after another until... Where do you think we're going to get to, Dennis?
Well, does that mean if you grow like 100 pounds, you get the death penalty?
Well, right now it comes to, I worked it out, it's about 60,000 plants imported would put you in that sentence bracket, or 1,000 sheets of LSD in the conventional 100 doses per sheet would get you into that
bracket. Now, is this going to apply also to the corporate heads of the large U.S. companies like Eli Lilly that send tons and tons of precursor material to South America for the making of cocaine? Will they be the board members of the large drug corporations who assist, therefore, in the manufacturing of real drugs like cocaine and heroin?
I would kind of doubt it.
I don't think
so. I don't want to offend anybody personally when I say this, but... And how many pounds of tobacco will it be sold to kids 13 and under.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is really something that is terribly gone wrong here.
And you especially see how wrong it's gone when you spend time overseas in Germany or in Holland, where the act, I'm speaking now in terms of marijuana, but in fact personal possession of any illegal material is no longer an indictable offense in Germany. The question that is being debated there is what constitutes an amount for personal use. The result of bringing in that kind of legislation is that peace descends. One feels at peace in Amsterdam. It's a decent country. You can walk around and nobody is bothered about the war on drugs. The police there go after major traffickers in heroin and cocaine. They don't bother with the marijuana smokers or the hash smokers or the LSD dealers or the mushroom dealers. You can go into a store in Amsterdam and buy psilocybin mexicana, fresh or dried. It is not something that attracts attention. A lot of people in Amsterdam don't even know about the existence of the coffee shop trade. It doesn't concern them. And as Roy was saying just now, the incidence of drug use in Holland is lower than that in neighboring France, and certainly lower than what it is in the United States. It's a sane, rational, humane policy which the Dutch and the Germans also are able to show us as an alternative.
Well, you know, I think it would be really important to figure out a way. I mean, this guy Eric Sterling, who first, you know who he is?
Mm-hmm.
The kind of experience he has at first in creating this monster,
mm-hmm.
as a congressional aide in 1986 when the Democrats mm-hmm. had to one bet of the Republicans
mm-hmm.
and really open up that game. Now calling for drug war crimes tribunals. I think that's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be really a good idea to have several of those and have people who know a lot about this stuff testify as a way of just throwing a spotlight on the bizarre nature of the situation. And there's a lot of issues that could be considered in something like that. But I think, I can't think of another way. We're very, at the legislative level, at the national structural level, we're very far. The legislators, you know, who are owned by, we don't need to go down that road, but you know what I mean, aren't near this.
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be some way that would be interesting to call attention to it, because we do, I mean, I hear what you're saying about the feeling free. The America, let's face it, the bottom line here is that sort of the American power structure has always had a problem with thinking drugs and visionary drugs. And because, you know, Jesus Christ, people are going to start, like, having critical visions, both, you know, at the spiritual, cultural level. Look where we, look how deep the censorship lives. Not, I don't mean in journalism. I mean cultural. Like, you can't read an Allen Ginsberg poem that's not censorable. I can't even do it on Pacifica. In fact, Pacifica's worse because they're so afraid. They're looking over their shoulder. So the fact that that culture is shredded wheat in America, I mean, this is all connected. And I think this needs to be, this kind of issue can be raised at like a tribunal, you know?
Well, the question of the control of information is, of course, important, but I don't think it's insuperable, that problem. It may be that the media distort and highly select the information on drug effects and drug risks that they choose to convey to the public, but we don't have to depend on the media. Listen to what you're doing right now, Dennis, and what I'm doing. We're talking to the public. We're trying to get through to people. We're telling people the truth. We're exercising the right that we still have to express our feelings and spread information. I think that's where the answer lies, not with writing letters to your elected representative for sure, because that is merely feeding into the corrupt system. What we need to do is to get through to the ordinary people who have an innate sense of decency, who can be moved by stories of the terrible things that are being done to their fellow citizens.
I totally appreciate that. I wish we could reach out more and do more. Roy, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
I'm wondering, I have some entertainment here for you guys if you're interested. I'm holding in my hand an internal police memo from the Commonwealth of Kentucky on this guy, Mark Lopez,
mm-hmm.
who was indicted on...
He was the one you were tracking around.
He was indicted on embezzlement and all kinds of things. But mm-hmm. it would make... You know, if you want, I could just read a few lines of this. Yeah, this guy was indicted 3 years ago. He's yet to go to trial, although all the people... The dozens of cases that he worked on in which he fucked people, which he you know, really forced people into jail.
It's called setting people up.
That's right. They're in jail. He still hasn't gone to trial. You mm-hmm. want to hear a few interesting things?
Yes.
This is what the police who investigated him found. His buddies found this. This is in the interest of public order, and this is in preparation of a hearing on this guy's career. Number one, that in the latter part of September and early part of October, Trooper Mark Lopez, that's 1993, while acting in his official capacity, threatened to pursue criminal charges against Troy Fugate, that's his informant, if he did not pay him a sum of money. Trooper Lopez did receive a sum of money in excess of $300 as a result of the threats. Such conduct constitutes criminal offense of theft by extortion. Number two, that for a period of time beginning on or about 14 July 1993 and continuing through 23rd October 1993, Trooper Lopez filled out approximately 15, and what he did is he filled out about dozens of forms to get lots of extra money. Then he goes on, I like this one a lot. it says here he put a gun to Mr. Troy Fugate's head when Mr. Fugate threatened to go public with the situation. Then he extorted money from Fugate's wife. And this thing goes on and on. This guy is responsible for putting scores of people in jail forever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is an open, now it's almost like a ritual. I call there every month to ask if he's been indicted yet.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is something, besides talking to each other, I think it's our job to monitor law enforcement, to figure out ways to do this, as journalists, as writers, as thinkers, to ask mm-hmm. questions about, you know, these people are in jail, you know, like who put them there? Who are all these, I don't know. It just drives me crazy. The more I listen to...
So is this the kind of question you'd bring before the tribunal?
Absolutely. Yeah. We could send out the people's subpoena for Mr. Lopez and ask him why he drove home a four-wheeler one day and used it for a weekend picnic with the other guys.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, you know, four sheriffs in that county were busted for running cover for major drug importers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the judges are, you know, this is just forever all over the place, but these guys don't go to jail. These judges just get richer and richer. They, you know, somebody gets kicked off the bench, they run for the sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they're still right there in the middle, get involved in serious drug operations with the various cartels. The police run protection. This is, it is an upside down world, and it's hard to convey to people you know, going to work every morning.
Mm-hmm. Without Lewis Carroll's help. This is KPFK Los Angeles. We are on the air talking with Dennis Bernstein on the phone, who has an article on POWs in the drug war in the upcoming April issue of Z Magazine, and Dr. John Beresford. We're going to take a break because of infringement which was committed by moi, and there are people awaiting retribution, not retribution, they're awaiting apology. So
Roy, I'm going to take off, though.
Okay.
I appreciate the time. Nice speaking with all of you there.
Okay, bye, Dennis.
Okay, thanks, Dennis. And you are listening to Something's Happening, KPFK Los Angeles, featuring Dynamite Radio for Night People, Monday through Thursday, midnight to 6 a.m. We have been talking with Dr. John Beresford of the drug war on tonight, another program on the drug war. And Dr. Beresford can be, if you want more information, you can be reached through the Committee on Unfit Sentencing?
Unjust.
You write like a medical doctor.
I guess
that's part of your psychiatric training.
Definitely.
Committee on Unjust Sentencing, and they are at, send them a self-addressed stamped envelope if you want a reply, and a reminder that everything costs money, even KPFK. The Committee on Unjust Sentencing, P.O. Box 76665 in Los Angeles, 90076. Committee on Unjust Sentencing, P.O. Box 76665 in L.A., 90076. And what is the program of the committee? What are actions being contemplated or planned, or is that what is being planned is planned?
It's an ongoing and evolving program, depending on the situation that is being faced. The most recent thing that we did was to stage this conference. It was indeed the first international conference on drug war prisoners in Heidelberg. It attracted 200 people from 12 different countries. There were five speakers, and the interests of the United States prisoners were represented by me, reading messages from these individuals, from 12 selected prisoners whose pictures I showed on the screen with slides. So I was able to tell people overseas some of the miseries that our people are going through, and there were other people from other countries doing similar work. So that was the latest thing that we've been doing.
Well, thank you for your work, Dr. Beresford, and welcome to Los Angeles now, and keep in mind when you have need of my good offices on Something's Happening KPFK. I'm in Los Angeles too, and we want to keep up on this very urgent question on this highly expensive operation, which is undoing our rights, costing us a lot of money, and torturing a lot of good people. Thanks for your work, Dr. Beresford.
Thank you, Roy, for having me.
KPFK Los Angeles.